I'm always looking for screen-free options to entertain my kids, especially my oldest when we have long car rides or things like that. And something that I really love using with him are podcasts. And there's a really cute new podcast called Mysteries About True Histories, which the acronym is MATH, M-A-T-H. And it's from the creators of the hit podcast Who Smarted and Netflix Brainchild. And it's all about the adventurous world of mysteries about true histories. And it follows these two characters, Max and Molly, who have just been recruited into a secret order of problem solvers. And they're on adventures through time, packed with puzzles, hidden equations, history, and it's really funny, which makes learning kind of cool. And it's perfect for ages 6 and up. So new episodes drop every Thursday, each stacked with so much laughter your kids won't even realize how much they're actually learning. And my oldest is about 6 and a half, and he loves stuff like this. So it's a great new podcast to introduce to your kids. The episodes are really short, like 15 to 20 minutes. So tune in to Mysteries About True Histories with your older kids. You can follow and listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Welcome back to the No One Told Us podcast, where we tell the truth about parenting and talk about all the stuff you wish you knew before having kids. I'm your host, Rachel Shepard-Ota, and today I am so excited to have the Jenny Best of Solid Starts. Jenny is a mom of three on a quest to help parents prevent picky eating and to find joy at the table together. Prior to launching Solid Starts on Instagram and on their website, Jenny led communications at various food nonprofits and served many years in the New York City government. And before that, she was a professional ballerina, which is like my favorite little fun fact about you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rachel. It's good to be here.
I'm so excited to have you because we've been in contact really since the beginning. Like, we started our accounts on Instagram maybe in the same month. Did you start in March 2020, yeah, like peak pandemic times? Yeah.
I must have been right before you then. I think I was in 2019. But yes, it was definitely okay. that moment in time.
That insane moment in time. And you were really like such a pioneer in the Instagram, like, quote unquote, parenting expert or, you know, whatever you want to call it, space. There really were not so many resources before you started your account. And I was super interested in baby-led weaning as a new mom when I started, you know, kind of like that food journey. And all I had was a book, really. So like your account and your resources were so helpful. And before we kind of dive into our conversation today, I would love to just hear from you as like a mom who built this incredible business and this incredible resource for other parents. How did you do that? Because you are also a mom of three. And so I know how hard it is. And you have been so incredibly successful. So I would love to hear how you did it, where you got the idea in the first place to start this type of a Instagram page.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because now our Instagram is actually one of the smaller sort of pieces of what we do. Our app is in the top 10% of the world, our free food database. We can kind of look and see how to cut any food for a baby. And we're writing two books and we've got like 17 million visitors with the website each month or something crazy.
So insane.
Every country in the world. I just found that out. Every country in the world is using our resources, which is like blows my mind. So, I never set out to build a business. I've actually never worked in the private sector in my entire life. I'm sort of a bleeding nonprofit heart type. I was very frustrated with my first go with Solids, with my firstborn. It didn't go well. He didn't like the purees. He really didn't like spoon feeding. And honestly, I'm not even sure he liked like just puree as a texture. It just didn't go well. And I didn't know any other way was possible. And so I kind of, you know, panicked and kept trying to force this certain, you know, traditional method on him. And he eventually stopped eating entirely. And down we spiraled, you know, I started pressuring him more at the table. And by the time my twins came around, I remember being pregnant thinking, I cannot do that part again like that. Like, I need to do my homework with starting Solids. And so I read all the books and I, you know, stumbled upon baby-led weaning and all that. And it kind of was like a light bulb in my head, like, oh my gosh, this is, I think, what my firstborn would have really benefited from in so many ways. And so I wanted to provide a visual resource for teaching babies to feed themselves and to show our experiment, because there really was no visual guidance in terms of infographics or even pictures of, well, how do you cut this cucumber? And you know, how do, can I see a 6 month old baby eating this steak? I know you're telling me that intellectually it's safe, but I need to see it for my own, for myself. I need to see it with my own eyes. And so we set out, gosh, I think my original campaign, it was originally a campaign, to be honest. I think we set out to try to introduce 1,000 foods to my twins, which was, you know, we're like not even close to doing, but I had this ambition of like, well, if anything can be made safe for baby, like why not try all the variety and document that and explore it and put it up on Instagram so others could learn from it. I really set out to do a campaign on introducing, you know, quote unquote, real food to babies and to really visually show that. And, you know, as you know, it caught on really quickly and kind of built mm-hmm. itself. And eventually, you know, I tried to answer every DM at the time, and I'd be up at 4 a.m. answering these DMs, trying to get back to every single one. And eventually you start seeing a lot of patterns, right? People are asking mm-hmm. you for the same exact thing and the same exact question, just phrased different ways. And so I was like, this is silly. I should just, you know, make a guide or something.
Yeah, exactly.
I made a few guides. And then not long after that, I realized we were on to something big, frankly, and quickly assembled a team of licensed feeding professionals, a pediatrician, an allergist, swallowing professionals, occupational therapists, you know, the whole lactation consultants, and the lovely algorithm, love-hate relationship there, and hashtags led me to find easily finding people who were also passionate about baby-led weaning and these things. And so I actually found our team, even our pediatrician and our allergist through Instagram, and then just sort of vetted them, you know, real deal outside of social media. And we discovered we were all so incredibly passionate about this, about changing the narrative and the story about how you should feed babies or how, you know, what choices you have in that adventure. And, you know, we all kind of worked for free together for about 3 years. And, wow. You know, just sort of recently started reinvesting the profit to grow. But I never set out to build a business. It's kind of funny to me that it is one because I still don't even see it as one. But yeah, it's gotten quite big at this point. It's a little, I don't think I could slow it down if I tried.
No, it's huge. And it's like, it's everything. It's such a genius name. Like people can remember it so easily. And you're like branding, just the way you present the information. And like you said, it's so visually based, which I think for busy, tired parents is so helpful. Cause like I said, like when we started with Starting Solids, I only had a baby led weaning book. And my husband looked at me like I was an insane person that I wanted to give my son a whole floret of broccoli. And I was like, no, it like the book says you can. Me reading the book was enough. I wasn't going to get him to read the book. So he just luckily trusted me. But now we have the app. I have a 14 month old now, and the app has been so incredibly helpful because we both just have it on our phone. If he's out with her without me and he's not sure how to give something to her, he just like looks it up quickly, and
beautiful.
It's just so convenient. And it just
I love
takes,
it. That's so good.
A lot of that funny, fear
I'm not
away.
An app person either. I'm not really an app.
No, me
person.
Either. Me either. It's one of the very
running
few.
A popular app. I would have laughed you out of town, but it just lent it. Actually, that I didn't set out to build an app either. I put the free food database for how to cut these foods on our website and just made it free and free forever. And then every single follower was like, I really need this in an app. I really need this in an app. I'm like, really? And then we did a grassroots funding campaign and the followers essentially funded it. So
amazing.
It was something that organically blossomed out of, I think, frankly, being a good listener, maybe like listening to what people needed and actually taking the time to interact one-on-one with each of the community members, which, you know, is easier to do when you have 10,000 followers. Now it's requires a large team to
millions,
do that.
Yeah,
but,
right.
Yeah, I built the thing I needed when I was a mom, and I wanted to kind of mom it forward in that way.
I love that so much. And I love, and this could be like a whole separate conversation, but I love that you have been so real and so open about things that you wish you did differently, things that you, you know, would consider were mistakes with your first, like we all make mistakes with our first kid and with all of our kids really. But I just love how open you are about that. And I've also noticed that you've kind of started to shift away from talking about your own kids' experience so much. Can you talk a little bit about that and why you've kind of made that shift and that decision?
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting. Like I'm a sort of communicator and connector by nature. I was always wanted to be a photographer, a filmer, a filmmaker in some way. And so my kids are really used to me, you know, filming them and taking pictures. It's not a day when I don't have, you know, it used to be my Nikon at my side, but now it's my iPhone in my yoga pants pocket.
Yeah.
So they're quite used to that. And I love storytelling and I love sharing in that format. And to me, you know, gosh, like had I had a resource that really showed me what to do when your kid was throwing food at you and saying, "This is the worst dinner ever." You can read a 300-page book about it, but you can almost have that same leap of knowledge when shown in a real time moment. So I wasn't shy about doing that. But as the account got bigger, and honestly, as you know, I've gotten older, my family's gotten older, my life is definitely less relatable now to a mom with a 6-month-old baby. that child is 8 years old, right?
Right.
So
right.
It's not really relevant anymore. But yeah, I mean, we're also just shifting, honestly, if I'm being candid, to the algorithm as well, because, you know, back in when we started, honestly, when we started stories, Instagram stories weren't even a thing. That was sort of a new reels right. and stories had not yet been formed. And yeah. A fantastic storytelling format to use. And the video, you know, is kind of king at this point. But it used to be that you post something and people saw it. And it was that simple. And and if you posted at 2 o'clock, they saw it at 2 o'clock or whenever they logged back in. And now I really do feel like all of us are sort of fighting with the algorithm. It's depressing everything. A fraction of your followers see your posts. And frankly, it's not like a great investment of time for us. The app is growing faster on its own without us doing anything just by word of mouth. So we don't have to work as hard and show up as much on social media as we did when we were just sort of building momentum, to be completely candid, but also too, like there's, you know, obvious downsides to, being vulnerable in front of, you know, a larger growing public. You're going to face more criticism. You're going to get more flack. You know, my kids are stopped on the street. People know who they are and they're sort of aware that, you know, they're kind of a public family in that way. And that was something I really wanted to, as much as I love the people who stop and say hello, I wanted to kind of stop that. So
yeah.
So we're, you know, I think today most folks don't really know who we are necessarily behind. It's just a large team of mostly medical professionals. And I'm kind of bringing the mom lens, taking all the medical jargon and the feeding therapy jargon, putting it through a lens that I think is understandable, easily digestible, forgive the pun, and ideally visual, right? So, you know, you can kind of go talk to a pediatrician or a swallowing therapist and they're like, okay, so here's the statistics on this and this is how this is going to work. But like, I'm going to take that information and show you that in a video so that you're like, aha, I get what you're saying. I know what you mean.
Absolutely. And I think that is why part of why you guys have been so successful too, is you do strike such a perfect balance of like, here's what it looks like in real life, in real homes. You show, you know, people from all over the world doing this for real with their real life babies. But then you also have this like incredible professional base of knowledge. And I think that just helps so much with trust, right? Where you feel like, this is a place I can go to get real evidence-based information, but like they're also moms who get it. And I get to see real babies that are like just like mine. And I think with something like feeding, that is so key, because something like gagging or choking or a baby eating a piece of steak, like you kind of do need to see that to fully get it. Because yeah, you can
absolutely.
Only
I used
about
to get
so
really
much.
Upset if folks called us like a mom blog or just an Instagram account. I'm like, just because we have an Instagram account does not mean that we are an Instagram team. Like, let me show you how much it costs to pay these medical professionals.
Right. They're oh my God.
Quasi institution at this point, sort of a medical institution, which is where we wanted to go. Now that we see we've got this momentum and tools that can be scaled and used are all around the world, we're hoping to actually shift toward becoming kind of a quasi medical institution, dare I say, akin to the respect of the AAP or Mayo Clinic, but for Amazing. This niche of feeding babies. And our recent launch was Solid Starts Pro, where dietitians, pediatricians, lactation professionals, you know, occupational therapists, you name it, can come get continuing education credit with our pro courses, our professional courses that are, you know, much longer and more geeky, like the neurobiology of swallowing and things like that. So I think long term, you know, you're going to see our books out there that'll be a bit evergreen and how to feed babies. You'll see our app continue to grow, and you'll see Solid Starts Pro really flourish with professionals around the world coming together for conferences and learning virtually with our trainers.
So cool. When I saw that you were launching that, I was like, this is exactly what we need. And what that's like one of my long-term, like lofty dreams too, is providing that information for the professionals that are actually seeing the parents every single day and that the parents are really listening to. Like, I can't tell you how many times, and you probably get it all the time too, someone will DM me right after their pediatrician appointment and be like, my pediatrician just told me this. Like, what do you think? And so much of the time it's like either really antiquated advice or really kind of judgy advice. And not all pediatricians. We have an amazing pediatrician. I know that there are incredible providers out there too. But there does seem to be this disconnect, right? Especially with things like sleep or feeding, where pediatricians are giving parents advice that is very conflicting with what they're saying
and
online.
And you know what? And we certainly experience that daily as well. We often get messages, you know, they're almost like a second opinion in nature, like my pediatrician said this, what do you think? And that shows some sort of lack of trust to begin with, if you're seeking a second opinion. But in the defense of pediatricians, what I will say is that I kind of think they're set up to fail in some ways because the age range that they cover is so large. So
Oh my gosh, large. Yes.
Even if you just focused on age 0 to 3, like allergen science, everything is so rapidly changing. You would have to constantly be doing continuing education to stay ahead of the curve on immunology, on, you know, all the things involved. So in their defense, it's a really like large set of material to stay on top of. But you know, the other thing is just that the institutions that guide them are also very slow, you know, to get something changed at the AAP level, it could take a couple of years. And by that time it's published, it's dated already again. So I think that it's nice that, you know, look, when there are gaps in knowledge or institutions and government institutions move too slowly, the people will respond and create the resources that we need. So thankfully we're nimble enough where we can do that. But gosh, I know. I wish we could get to the pediatricians more efficiently. It's one of the challenges we're having right now that I need to crack is how do we get directly to the pediatrician? Because if you try to go through the AAP, it's just going to take too long and be too slow. So we're hoping that we attract more pediatricians to take our pro courses, and they're not even long, right? Like some of them, you know, maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours, you get continuing education credit, which you have to do anyway. So hopefully we can attend more conferences and get to the doctors. So the level of information that is being circulated is at least like, you know, within the last couple of years of research and evidence.
Yeah. Parents deserve
that. I imagine the sleep world is probably just fraught with opinionated, I would say probably a lot of opinionated dispenses of information that maybe are not rooted in any kind of evidence.
No, it's really, really rough out there. It's really rough for the advice parents are getting about sleep.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about antiquated. And a lot of it is opinion-based too, right? Like a lot of it, like you said, like with sleep, there's really not tons and tons of data that we have. So a lot of it is just based on like, this is what I did with my kids, or this is what worked for my other patients, or something like that. And it's tough. I get lots of those messages every day, and it kind of breaks my heart. But that's why like something like a pro program, like what you're talking about with Solid Starts, would be my like dream project, is just something to like, you know, say, here, doctors, give this to your patients, tell them this. I don't know. It's just, it's tough when parents feel like there's just this overabundance of information, and then they don't know who to trust, who to listen to, what's right, what's not right. It's overwhelming.
My hope, and I think this will happen eventually, is that in some way, you know, Solid Starts disrupted a traditional norm that was held to be the way you had to do things. You know, you had to do things for baby food or a pouch, and that was the only way. In stage one of thickness, stage two of thickness, and gradually, what we now know is that there is zero evidence behind that approach. And it was just a marketing exercise by baby food companies back in the 1950s that just sort of stuck, but who were very successful in getting to the pediatricians, by the way. You could get a free sample of Gerber from your pediatrician if you wanted, because money and marketing, they did their thing. So I'm hoping to reverse some of that pathway, but through the public, right? So now we've got parents asking their pediatrician about baby-led weaning. We have parents asking their pediatrician about alternatives to a hyper-controlled spoon feeding kind of approach, or just, you know, rice cereal or textureless food. And the pediatricians are starting to realize that they're behind the curve if they don't
They need to learn
a thoughtful answer to that. So in some way, the public demand is the parents are creating the demand in the pediatricians, and I think they'll have to kind of catch up sooner or later.
Yes, that's so true. Okay, I want to come back after the break and talk about what you just said, which was kind of like the spoon feeding versus baby-led weaning. We'll be right back.
Now, if you know me, you know that I love to cook and I love creating healthy meals for my family. But even more than that, I love things that are easy and convenient. And even though I love to cook dinner for my kids, sometimes for things like lunches or if I'm just going to be working at night and need something easy for myself to grab, I love Factor's meals. And especially now in the spring and summertime where we've got more plans, we're busier, we're outside, we're going out and doing things more, having Factor meals in my fridge is such a game changer because they're healthy, they're zero prep, and they're so fresh and delicious. Factor's fresh and never frozen meals are dietitian approved and ready to eat in just 2 minutes right from your microwave. So no matter how busy you are, you always have time to enjoy nutritious and great tasting meals. And when I tell you they are actually delicious, I 100% recommend these. My mom even recently asked me, are they really good? I heard you talking about them on your podcast, but are you really saying that you like them? And I said, yes, you have to order them. They are actually so, so yummy. So what are you waiting for? There are 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons you can choose from each week. So you always have new flavors to explore. You'll never get bored with the same old meals. They truly taste like restaurant quality, so you don't feel like you're depriving yourself of anything. It actually feels like you're fueling up your body with delicious food that is real and super, super nutrient dense. So you can enjoy this effortless support to your lifestyle, choose from 6 menu preferences to help you manage whatever goals you have, and simply just eat well-balanced, delicious, easy food. Head to factormeals.com/nooneToldUs50 and use code nooneToldUs50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. So this is an amazing deal. That's code nooneToldUs50 at factormeals.com/nooneToldUs50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% of your next month while your subscription is active. And feel free to send me a message and ask me for my favorite meals because I love talking about them and I'll be happy to help you choose. Today's podcast is sponsored by Active Skin Repair, a skin health company helping people heal with natural, non-toxic, and medical-grade ingredients. Active Skin Repair can be used to treat a wide range of skin issues, including cuts, scrapes, burns, sunburn, rashes, and other types of skin damage. And the best part is that it's safe and non-toxic, which makes it suitable for use on all skin types and all parts of the body, even with rosacea, eczema, or acne-prone skin. With over 500,000 happy customers and thousands of 5-star reviews and ingredients so safe and clean they can be used from the littlest member of your family to the oldest, you now have one simple solution for all your family's skin health needs. I have 3 kids. We have injuries in our house almost daily, and so it's so nice to have Active Skin Repair to reach for in my cabinet because I know that it's safe, natural, and non-toxic. We use it for things like burns or scrapes or cuts. My youngest daughter recently had a really bad finger injury and we were using it on her and it did not sting or burn her at all. So it was perfect. Today, as a listener of this podcast, you can get a special discount on your order of Active Skin Repair. Visit activeskinrepair.com to learn more, and to get 20% off your order, use code NOONETOLDUS. That's activeskinrepair.com, code NOONETOLDUS for 20% off your order.
Okay, Jenny, so let's talk about this whole idea of baby-led weaning. I don't know about you, but I obviously am a consumer, not only a creator, but I'm a consumer of social media content. And one thing that I see a lot of is this idea that like there's baby-led weaning or there's spoon feeding and you have to pick one and there's one that's superior. And if you don't do it this way, you're a bad mom. What do you have to say about that? Because obviously Solid Starts is a great, like incredible resource for baby-led weaning, but there are still a lot of parents that are scared to try baby-led weaning or that decide they just really don't want to do it for some reason. So what is kind of your take on this, like, mommy wars or culture wars about, like, baby-led weaning versus spoon-feeding?
The dichotomy is not helpful, and it's also unnecessary, because when we really look at the positive aspects of, let's say, both styles, starting with the spoon feeding of textureless food, purees, that type of approach, versus letting baby feed themselves, pick up finger food or table food. When you really look at the benefits of those things, what we really see, like the biggest benefits, in my opinion, baby-led weaning is, well, first you've got the neurological choice. Baby decides to eat, which is both good for building a good food relationship. I'm deciding what I eat and what goes into my mouth when and how quickly. But also the trust that's really kind of built into that relationship. I'm going to trust my baby to pick up that food, put it in their mouth, and to stop eating when they're full. You know, what's really interesting to me is that, and I think this goes back to bottle feeding and breastfeeding, there is a term called responsive feeding that's kind of, in my opinion, rising from the ashes. So if you have a canyon and you've got spoon feeding on one side and baby-led weaning on the other side, put any two things in parenting on those sides, sleep training, bed sharing, formula, breastfeeding, whatever the camps are. You've got a canyon in between. And when it comes to feeding, I really want all the quote unquote methods to go away. This is food. We all need to eat. We all need to sleep. There doesn't have to be a method for every single thing in our lives. There doesn't have to be a method for a particular diet or a particular way of exercise or a particular way of practicing, you know, one's whatever, yoga. Like I'm kind of done with methods. What I would like and what I think we're seeing and what I'm hoping to foster is this refocusing back on what is called responsive feeding, not responsive bowl, but responsive feeding, which is basically just being in tune with your child, feeding them when they are hungry, stopping when they are full, honoring and trusting your baby throughout that process, knowing that they will communicate, trusting that they will communicate to you when they're hungry, and that they'll communicate fullness as well. And that just because there's a little more left in the pouch or the jar doesn't mean you need to be scraping the bottom and getting that one more bite in. If baby is full, baby is full, you can stop. Or if baby just not having it, right? Even if you think they're hungry, then it's time to go back to that, you know, bottle or breastfeed. That's okay too, especially in the first year of life where that's a primary source of nutrition. Anyway, so my hope is to actually refocus everyone on what really matters here, which is trusting your child. And whether that's trusting them to grab the spoon from you and to put that puree in their own mouth, or trusting them to pick up a piece of finger food and to know when they're full, hungry versus, you know, all of that. To me, it really comes, it boils down to trust. And I think if people need a name to attach to it, let it be responsive feeding. We actually dropped the baby-led weaning moniker from our account a couple of years ago because what I was really realizing is that, well, first, I didn't want to further the dichotomy. And, you know, look, I can be a pretty forward and candid speaker in these forums. And, you know, people probably see me as a baby-led weaning advocate because I talk about the neurological, the science-backed reasons to let baby feed themselves. But what we're really talking about is not withholding chewable food from babies. Because what we know is that from 6 to 8 months of age, babies have built-in automatic reflexes that help them learn how to chew. And it's not that if you start introducing chewable food at 9 or 10 months of age, the baby won't learn. They will. Of course they will. Like your grandmother said, well, I was fine. She was. She will be.
Right.
But it's actually easier to do from 6 to 8 months of age. And in a lot of ways, it's safer as well, because the other reflexes that baby has from 6 to 8 months of age that are really kind of prime and sensitive are the protective reflexes against choking. They're kind of at their all-time high in the 6 to 8 month age range. So it's like this beautiful magic window that you've got where babies body is primed to teach them how to chew through repetition and automatic reflexes. If you put your finger on baby's gums, a 5-month-old, they're going to bite down on you. And that happens, that kind of phasic bite reflex continues to happen through 6 to 8 months. The protective reflexes, tongue thrust, gagging, coughing, these are also very sensitive in a 6 to 8 month-old baby, but some of those start to fade with age. Meaning like for you and I to gag on a piece of food, that food has to get pretty far back in our throat to elicit that kind of retching motion to protect it from getting into the airway going down the wrong tube. For a baby to gag, it only has to hit the middle of their tongue. So that reflex is further forward in the mouth. So from a feeding therapist perspective, and our feeding therapists teach the neurobiology of swallowing as well as the neurobiology of choking, they love that, like that magic window, that 6 to 8 month period of time, because not only is the body primed to learn how to chew food at that time without baby even necessarily trying, the protective reflexes are super sensitive. So it creates this kind of fertile environment for learning and safely making mistakes. We like to say we're not worried about the 6-month-old with a hunk of steak. We're worried about the 12-month-old that's never had any chewable food and now has a pincer grasp and can pick up small toy parts or small, you know, a peanut or a pistachio shell. When you look at choking data in emergency rooms, we've analyzed, oh my gosh, like exhaustively for the last 5 years, the likelihood of choking is actually higher in toddlerhood. But the overall, the risk of choking is actually really low. It's less than 1%
in
age 4. This is a misconception that media has sort of, I think they misinterpret, I think like, you know, like Fox News or whoever, you know, they misinterpret the CDC data, which is categorized kind of oddly. It's, you have to really know what you're doing to make sure you get it. And what happens is media will report like choking is the leading cause of death under age 4 when it's actually like far from it. It's less than 1%. And half of those instances are not on food. They're on
objects,
marbles, batteries, jewelry, grandma's, you know, whatever. Like in a lot of ways, our worries about choking are far out of proportion with the statistical likelihood of them happening. So I'm sorry.
Oh my gosh, that makes me feel so much better because my followers that have been with me for a long time know that choking is like my number one phobia with my kids, even though it's never happened. Yes, okay. It's never happened, but I used to get, and I still do sometimes, like the worst anxiety when I knew my kids were going to be with somebody else and that they were going to be eating. It was just like my thing. And I still get comments, like I posted a lunchbox idea the other day for my 6-year-old and someone messaged me like, aren't grape tomatoes and string cheese major choking hazards as per Solid Starts? I'm like, guys, just because like a baby could choke on it does not mean that I can't give it to my 6-year-old and you're not helping me with my choking phobia. Please stop. So that just made me feel so much better. I love it. So I've got to watch out for the marbles and the batteries and the Legos instead.
Yeah. And email me and I'll send you the data too, because you know, what's really relevant for your audience and your account, Rachel, is that the sleep issues and SIDS are, you know, really, far outweigh, unfortunately, the fatalities. And, you know, it's really the things we should really be nervous about as parents are suffocation and sleep, whether that's, you know, a pillow or a blanket or a body, human body, and drowning, bathtub, pools, any body of water. It's not intuitive even to toddlers that they can put their hands down and push their chest up out of the water. So if you actually attend like, you know, swim classes with babies, then if it's a really good class, they'll teach the toddlers in shallow water how to push up their hands. But it's car accidents, it's drowning, it's SIDS, it's sleep stuff, choking. You know, if you did a line chart, you wouldn't even see a line because it would be so flat.
Oh my gosh. Okay. That makes me feel a lot better. So what then would be like, if someone has major anxiety about starting solids, regardless of what philosophy, I don't even want to use the word method because I love what you just said, regardless of, you know, their philosophy with how they approach food, what would be like the number one thing you would tell them to kind of ease that anxiety, to feel confident and feel comfortable with giving their child food?
Yeah. I have three things. First, the The research shows that when humans feed themselves, regardless of age, that the choking risk is infinitely lower. Mm. And think about it. It makes sense. Think about someone else putting food in your mouth. You're kind of like not really ready for it. But yeah, when you cognitively look at the food, you decide, I see that food. I'm going to pick up that food. I'm intentionally placing it in your mouth. Not only are your salivatory, I don't know the term. You start salivating.
Salivatory? That sounds right.
Your brain starts to prepare for eating, and you are much more ready to coordinate all the 50 muscles that are required for thorough chewing and safe swallowing. So self-feeding is actually one way to reduce the risk. If you're not ready for table food or finger food, let baby grab the spoon from you. That's really important. So number one is let your baby feed themselves. Mm-hmm. Number two, if you're really anxious about choking, start with food teethers. So when it's, when you're, moving past purees or whatever your next step is, look for unbreakable foods that baby can't take a bite of. So the seed of a mango pit, like the inner seed of a mango, the mango pit, you can take off most of the fruit and let baby kind of teethe on that. They're getting a little bit of the fruit, but they're also like poking and prodding their mouth and strengthening their jaws at the same time. So it's a low risk, high reward type of food. Other examples of that would be like corn on the cob. If you're really nervous, take all the kernels off. The cob will certainly advance the chewing skills and the reflexes and help baby's brain form a mental map of the mouth with all the poking and prodding it will do. We have a list of these foods on our website. It's allstarts.com. If you just put in teethers and you go, oh, can't they learn that with a rubber teether or a silicone teether? They can. Sort of. The brain learns best in context. So the brain learns more quickly if it's about eating food. Using a food teether will advance those skills more quickly. And the third thing I would say, even though the choking risk is less than 1% under age 4, and that includes babies, even though it is very unlikely that baby will choke, the baby's body is really designed to protect itself. There's multiple layers of defense when it comes to preventing food from going down the wrong tube and into the airway. Even then, still do the infant rescue maneuvers, watch those. We have a course that shows them with real babies, both toddlers and young babies, because I took the course, but like you're working with a doll. Like, come on.
Yeah, it's not the same.
It's not nearly as heavy or as wiggly or as scary. So that was one of the things when we built our video courses, I wanted to show, have our doctors and show the maneuvers with a real screaming child, like a real, show me how this really works. Do those and know it like the back of your hand. We have a free infant rescue guide you can put on the wall. It's visual. Put it, where your baby is eating so that you're never having to look up the instructions in the moment. Because the thing is that once you know those maneuvers and you understand that they are extremely effective, you start to feel more comfortable because you're like, I know what to do. I really know what to do. I liken it to when I had to first use the EpiPen with my firstborn who had a severe allergic reaction. We knew he had allergies by that point. So I had all the equipment in the house, but I never had to use it until this one day. And it's a big needle. It's a big needle. It was so scary. So I called 911. Even though the instructions are on the EpiPen, I kind of wanted 911 there because he was having an anaphylactic reaction,
a life-threatening
reaction, and it was starting to stop breathing and all of that stuff. So I called 911, I put it on speaker, and he said, okay, open the EpiPen. Okay, pull it out. And then he said, this is what you're going to do. On the count of three, you and I together, you're going to put that into his thigh. Ready? Let's go. 1, 2, 3, swing, boom. And within seconds, he was fine. It was like magic. It worked instantly. And that he actually was, by the time the firefighters banged down my door and came rushing in, he was like playing with a toy, like, hey guys, what's up? I share that example, as terrifying as it sounds, because after I did the EpiPen that one time, I was no longer afraid. And hopefully you'll never need to use the rescue maneuvers in the situation of choking. But well, actually, you want to know what's more likely? Probably going to save someone else's child in a restaurant. People always ask us, you know, where there's distractions, or Disneyland where there's popcorn, or a movie theater where there's a big distraction, sudden noises. People always ask us, you know, do we need a life vac? Do we need a choking, an anti-choking device, these like suction devices? And the initial research, and we've done thorough testing of the products ourselves, our doctor has, the initial research is promising, to be candid. It's promising, but it's highly unlikely you're going to have it with you.
Right.
So I don't want parents buying these devices in lieu of knowing proper CPR and rescue maneuvers. Right. Because if you're not going to carry it with you to Disneyland, you're not going to have it on the airplane, you're not going to have it at a restaurant. At some point when you get comfortable, you think your toddler's eating really well, you're going to stop caring about it. And that's likely when something could go wrong. Sort of like when we let our guard down, there's a lot of distractions going on, maybe eating a food the child is not necessarily comfortable with. They're talking, they're laughing. The real way to reduce the risk of choking is actually typically about the environment the child is in. Are they sitting completely upright? Yes, check. Are they sitting down, first of all? A lot of toddlers, if you look at the emergency room data, they're running around with like high-risk foods like popcorn, candy, things that are served at picnics outside. There's a lot of freedom to eat and run. So, you know, you want to create a safe eating environment that is ideally calm, free of distractions, upright high chair, no reclined eating, not even a bit. Don't feed in the car seat. Don't feed in the stroller. Pull the stroller over for a little bit. And when you are on the go and you absolutely are, you know, you're stuck in traffic and they're screaming in the back, that's a great time for a pouch, right? Like something super low risk that you're not going to have to worry about. It's going to be messy, but
but you know what though? I recently found these incredible toppers for pouches on Amazon, and they're life-changing because I can give it to her in the car. And she won't squirt it all over the place. She has to, you have to like bite a little bit on it or something. I don't know, but life-changing.
I love it. So we want to create a safe environment, and just know that your baby's body really has their back. It is physiologically designed to protect itself.
I love that. It comes back to what you were saying at the beginning, all about trust, right? Jenny, right when we come back, I want to talk about pickiness, and I want to ask you about what you would do differently right when we come back.
Sounds good.
Lynn, this time of year, parenting can be such a flusterclux.
You've come to the right place. I'm Lynn Lyons, and I've been treating anxious families for over 30 years.
I'm Lynn's sister-in-law and co-host Robin Hudson.
Join us for Flusterclux, a podcast for parents who worry.
Wait, that's everybody.
Yeah, these last few years have felt like one long anxiety attack for so many.
Why do you think parents are always surprised that a podcast about anxiety relates to them, even if no one in their house has an anxiety disorder?
Well, worry is human. Everyone does it. And anxiety shows up when we face uncertainty.
All the parenting tips you've taught me have been essential.
I love to break it down into skills we need to manage worry in our families.
We've covered so many topics: depression, burnout, meltdowns, perfectionism.
Don't forget scary mothers-in-law.
Right, but of course that's not my mother-in-law.
Because that's my mother.
And a listener.
As a psychotherapist, I like to teach parents and kids how to respond to everyday moments in healthy ways.
Managing anxiety really can be taught.
It really can. And I'll even tell you what to say.
We talk about serious stuff, but without being too serious.
Anxiety wants everything serious. Anxiety doesn't stand a chance when we're laughing, even about the tough stuff.
Hey, are you a parent of a teenager? Are you feeling overwhelmed about how to be what they need while also holding limits and boundaries that keep them safe? Are you tired of conversations that negate how messy this season of parenting is? Well, I've got you. My name is Casey O'Rourke. I am a positive discipline trainer, parent coach, and the host of the Joyful Courage podcast. Every week, I come to you with an interview, digging into tough topics with experts I trust and solo shows that go deep into the personal growth and mindset needed to raise teens in a way that grows them into confident, capable young people. I am not afraid of getting real about the intersection of conscious parenting and the teen years, while also bringing in vulnerability, humor, and lightness. I'm walking the path with you and honored to serve. Listen to Joyful Courage on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you consume podcasts.
Okay, we're back. And Jenny, at the top of the episode, you kind of talked about how you approached feeding with your first and it, in your opinion, led to some picky eating. And picky eating is something that probably many parents deal with, if not when they're babies, then when they're bigger kids. I used to brag all the time about my kids eating because I was like, oh, we did baby-led weaning. They're not picky at all. They eat salmon. They eat absolutely everything. And now they're 4 and 6 and I make, you know, a delicious dinner every night. And most of the time they say, that's gross. I'm not eating that. What advice do you have for parents for preventing picky eating, if that's even possible? And then when the inevitable picky eating phase comes, how do we approach that?
Ah, such good questions. I love it. Okay. So first of all, there's a difference between run-of-the-mill toddler selectivity and what a feeding therapist might classify as like severe picky eating. There's a really big difference. When we talk about, I think when parents talk about picky eating, most of the time they're talking about toddler selectiveness, which looks like they used to eat broccoli and now they don't, or they used to eat this and now they don't, or they used to eat chicken and now they won't. And the difference between that and true picky eating is more like intense screaming at the table because the texture is like freaking them out, or unwillingness to even touch the food because they don't want to get their hands sticky or slimy, or only eats like maybe less than 20 foods and that's it. Is brand loyal. I can't eat those chicken nuggets because they're not shaped like dinosaurs, or I won't eat those chicken fingers at a restaurant because they're not like the ones I've had at home. So you can start to see there's actually a really big difference between what we would call toddler selectivity and picky eating. And we have on our website, itsallstarts.com, a questionnaire. You can kind of take yourself through to know like, which bucket am I in here? Is this the regular toddler bucket?
That's so
helpful. Do I need help bucket? Yeah.
So it sounds like there's a sensory component too. Sorry to interrupt you, but it sounds like there's a big piece of it that's sensory.
Okay. There often is, but not always. What's actually at the root of most severe picky eating tends to be, if you put neurodivergence aside, just put that aside for a moment because that's sort of a small percentage of the cases, it tends to be anxiety. And that can come from a number of different ways. If they've never been allowed to touch food or have been taught that food is dirty, you're so messy, I'm going to aggressively wipe your face right now. That can, if they've ever been force-fed, they're scared to come to the table. If they've never dealt with any texture food in their mouth, they may be gagging intensely. You know, I used to share with folks that my four-year-old would gag on the same food more than my eight-month-old twins when he was 4 and they were 8 months. Wow. Because he never, I delayed, I had him on purees until he was almost 2. So when he was first introduced to chewable food, he had no idea what to do with it in the mouth. His brain was confused. His body was confused. You know, he's mostly been living off of smoothies and purees and pouches because I was so afraid. So once we separate toddler selectivity and picky eating, just kind of note they are very different, but the term picky eating is kind of used interchangeably. First, let's talk about the regular toddler situation, because that's actually the more likely scenario that most of the parents listening are going to experience. You're going to feed your baby all these foods, and around 12 to 18 months of age, they're going to start rejecting those foods. This is normal. This is normal. This is your moment to feign indifference. And what I mean by that is to kind of act like you don't care. Oh, you're not interested in dinner tonight? Okay, well, that's all right. Let's move on to story time and breakfast will be there tomorrow. Yeah. And what happens in this moment where toddlers start kind of trying to control food, it's one of the only things they have control over at their age, which is one of the reasons we love offering choices served at the same time. So don't just put like this, you know, one chicken and this, you know, one vegetable, like, hey, should we have broccoli or bell peppers tonight, or even offer them both at the same time in small portions. And the child feels they have a little bit of choice and agency in it. Toddlers are in a sort of wired to push back. They're wired to push boundaries. And when they see it bothers you, they kind of like it and they're going
it's
to
so
do
much
it
more fun for them. Yeah.
So much more fun. And and it lasts for a long time, this phase. It can last for 2 to 3 years. And so people start thinking, oh, I did baby led weaning and now my child just eats chicken nuggets and whatever. And so it failed. It didn't work. It actually has a lot more to do with the parent child relationship than how you started solids. Mm. So yes, there are lots of studies that show the more variety, colors, textures, mouth tastes, you know, flavors, whatever a baby is exposed to before 12 months of age, the more likely it is they'll be open to new foods and to eating vegetables. That's true. That is true. But most children will go through a period of selectivity where they kind of will winnow down what they're willing to eat. It's in that moment as a parent where you can kind of nudge them into the lane of exploring and learning, or you can reinforce the problem. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think we've all had these days where we're just like, screw it, just eat goldfish for dinner. Like, I don't care. You know what I mean? Like, you're just like done. And we call those short game days at Solid Starts. Yeah. You're allowed to have them. You know, you have the poop blowout and one hit over there, and this toddler's jumping from the window over there, and you just burnt dinner, and like, you have short game days. It's real. It happens.
You got to pick your battles sometimes.
It's okay. You know, goldfish for dinner, whatever, leftover pancakes for dinner. Like, it's okay. Food is food. But what we want to kind of refrain from is engaging with that downward spiral. So let's say your toddler says, I am not eating your chicken. That's the worst chicken ever, and throws it across the room. And I only want chicken nuggets. That's the only thing I'm going to eat is chicken nuggets. Chicken nuggets, chicken nuggets, chicken nuggets. And so tomorrow you serve chicken nuggets because you just don't want to deal with the tantrum or the breakdown. When we start kind of only serving what is being demanded at the toddler level, we end up reinforcing the problem and you're going to downward spiral. And you may end up in a more severe picky eating situation. We like to say, don't go back to the kitchen. Think of how to try to prevent that scenario at the outset. Okay, so let's say the child hasn't eaten any protein in 2 weeks. You're kind of panicking. You want some protein in the meal. Let's make 2 chicken nuggets available. And then the rest of the chicken that you planned that night. And, you know, this is all we have for tonight, but you have a choice of these nuggets and this chicken drumstick and this rice and these vegetables. And at the moment when they eat the 2 chicken nuggets and then demand chicken nuggets, we don't have any more chicken nuggets on the menu tonight, but you have rice and you have this other chicken. Do you think we should chop this chicken or eat it off the bone? I'm going to take a bite of mine and eat off the bone and see if that tastes good. Well, I wonder if I dip mine in ketchup, if it'll taste good. Is there something we could add to this? And you start kind of getting them in a mode of problem solving and exploring and self kind of owning the situation, being in control of solving the problem at hand, which is there are no more chicken nuggets on the menu tonight. You can set a boundary there. Boundaries are okay. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, evil to children need boundaries. It's okay. We kind of call them loving boundaries. You can set a boundary, but you know, you can also try to prevent the situation from happening, which is like, okay, let's make some choices available served at the same time. Don't have a pattern where you go back to the, okay, if dinner is thrown out, okay, let's go have a bar, right? Like those things that happens and it really reinforces the problem. So I think I've got a little off topic here, but you wanted to talk about preventing picky eating for the mothers with the parents with the young babies here who want to actually avoid picky eating. I would say as soon as you feel comfortable, serve your child the food you are eating. Yeah. Serve the family meal as soon as you're comfortable. Our feeding therapists with their second, third kids, like after they've gotten comfortable, they don't even do like, they just offer exactly what they're eating.
Oh yeah. It's so much easier that way.
And you can adapt. You can use our app to adapt the chicken or whatever you're serving that night to see how do I cut it in a safe way for a baby's age and eating ability, but serve the same food. And when you start getting to that toddler moment where they're like, I just want a snack. I don't want that. Or I just want this thing in a package. I don't want that. You have a choice of how often you make those things available. I love serving snacks and desserts and things that kind of tend to steal the show, to be honest, in unlimited quantities at snack time. because mm-hmm. then the child has a choice, like, oh, I'm going to have cookies or popcorn or whatever, this bar for a snack. And it kind of gets it out of the way. And there's no limitation or restriction on it. It's like, this is what's available for snack. Which one would you like? Get it out of the way. Maybe serve a glass of milk. So there's a little protein with it. And then by dinner, it's just what we're having. And that's that. Right. That's what's on the menu.
I love that. Jenny, before we go, this has been such an amazing conversation. Thank you so much. And one thing that I always try to ask parents that come on the podcast is, what is something, it could be food related or completely different, what is something that you wish someone had told you before you became a mom for the first time?
Well, I wish they had told me that I should introduce finger food or chewable food earlier than I did. Yeah. But then I wouldn't be here. I don't know.
Right,
that was probably my biggest pain point as a parent, was just not having enough information about solids. Now yeah. I think the pain point might be that there's too much information, you know, yes. Social media. There was like, that wasn't a thing when I was a parent, right? I just got like a tear off from my pediatrician that was like a half a piece of paper with 4 tablespoons of rice cereal. And
oh, God. This,
and it was like, no. That's all I get here, because this is super scary. So for me, it was that. But I think, I don't know. I think my advice at this point is choose your people wisely. The algorithm's going to push all sorts of stuff in your feed, and it's going to push advertisements for different, you know, things in every aspect of your life, whether you know it's happening or not. Find the people whose values seem to match with yours, your sort of parenting philosophy or life philosophy. Check their background. Are they real deal? Is there a real team here? Or is it just a blog, right? Like, let's check the background. And if those two things match up, then honestly, just like follow one or two.
Yeah.
And like put your blinders onto the rest of it, because you can trust your gut. Before all of the, you know, books and accounts and everything else, we just had our little villages and our gut. And most of the time, your gut is actually going to be right. So I'd love to see this next generation of parents trust themselves and their babies a little bit more.
So well said. I completely agree. Thank you so much, Jenny. Where can everybody find your amazing resources?
Yeah. So our app is the most popular thing. You can just go to the app store on iPhone or Android, Google Play, and download the Solid Starts app. Look for our blue logo. The full database of how to cut foods is also on our website at solidstarts.com. So there's lots of resources there. And we have, you know, guided meal plans and things like that for the folks who want to have a little bit more of a handheld process. So solidstarts.com, get everything there.
Awesome. Yeah, the guides are amazing. There's so much information about allergies and choking and gagging and serving sizes, portions, like everything that you could possibly need is there. So thank you so much for just providing such incredible resources for us parents who had no idea what we were doing. But now we do. Thanks to you guys. So thank you so much. And I will chat with you soon.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me.
I'm Margaret.
And I'm Amy.
And together we host the podcast, What Fresh Hell? Laughing in the Face of Motherhood.
Margaret, I would say you're sort of a where are my keys kind of mom.
Correct. Sometimes a where are my kids kind of mom. Well, you're, Amy, more of a we were supposed to leave 35 seconds ago, mom.
I mean, touche. In each episode of What Fresh Hell, we come at a topic from our usually completely opposite perspectives. I bring the research.
And I bring kind of the gimlet eye. Like, is that research really going to work, people?
And almost 10 million downloads later, we're still laughing.
We also talk to experts in the parenting field, plus parents with stories we can all learn from.
We make each other laugh, we challenge each other's assumptions, and we have what we think is the best parenting community on the internet.
Check out What Fresh Hell, Laughing in the Face of Motherhood, wherever you listen to podcasts.